This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Later this hour, we're going to explore the lack of affordable housing and the many ways that it impacts people across Southwest Florida. But first, we have taken the show on the road today. We're at the Harry Chapin Food Bank's Fort Myers warehouse to meet some of the people who work to bring food to those in need all across the region. The food bank's been operating in Southwest Florida since 1983. It partners with church food pantries, soup kitchens, emergency shelters, and disaster relief agencies to provide food for about 28,000 people each and every week in Lee, Charlotte, Collier, Glades, and Hendry counties. Last year, the food bank distributed 22.3 million pounds of food. That equates to 18.6 million meals with a total value of more than $37 million. Joining me now to explain how this process works is Miriam Pereira. She is the Director of Development here at the food bank. Miriam, thanks so much for being here.
For bringing the show on the road.
We're also joined by Carrie LaForte. She is the food bank's director of programs. Carrie, it's nice to talk to you as well.
Hi, thanks for having us.
We're not taking phone calls during today's show, but if you would like to chime in on our conversation, you can do so on social media. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag of GCL. So, Miriam, let's start by painting a scene of where we are, what's happening around us in this building.
So right now, it's actually a little quiet despite the creaky door outside here in the hallway. And what we do is it's a beehive of activity, usually with trucks coming and going, partner agencies coming and going. We have food coming in the door every day. Our drivers are out either collecting food from the 140-plus grocery stores in the five-county area where we collect food from, and food is being delivered from fresh produce this time of year in particular from either growers in town, regionally throughout the state of Florida, partner agencies coming to pick up their food, or it being delivered. So our trucks are packing up and going, and just a little while ago, our trucks were packing up to do two mobile pantries this afternoon.
So you have the mobile pantries that mm-hmm. load up here and head out. So this is kind of like the central location yeah. where all, how much food moves through here all the time?
Oh my gosh. We averaged it out one day, and I wanted to say it's somewhere about 80,000 pounds of food a day if you did the math, and I'm sure that number is probably wrong by now.
Yeah.
Because this past year we did 24 million pounds of food, so it keeps growing each fiscal year, and especially things like fresh produce and the frozen meat that we were lucky enough to receive from the grocery stores in our area, that moves very, very quickly.
Right.
But even if it didn't, it would, you know, if we could store it for a few extra days, it moves fast. If you go into the coolers, maybe 2 or 3 days ago, it was packed to the rafters with produce, and you go in there now, not so much. It just moves very fast.
So how many people are in this building at any given time?
Oh, that's a good question. We have about 60 employees in total. The mothership here in Fort Myers is the site for most of them, and we have about 6 people who work in our facility down in Naples.
It's a lot bigger than I had imagined.
It's about 55,000 square feet.
Yeah, that's not small. Is there something going on here 7 days a week?
No, 5 days a week, and then on Saturdays we have either a mobile pantry or we have volunteers here. We have a core group of volunteers who come in on Saturdays.
All right. So I'm going to turn now to you. What, Ms. LaPorte, describe for me how the process works. Where does the food all come from? Is it always coming from grocery stores or are these donations?
So it's not. It's all of the above. We work with 140 grocery stores throughout the community that we pick up food from. We also work with growers that we get produce from, donations that if your church does a food donation, that comes to us. So it's all different sorts of places.
Can people drop off stuff here?
They can.
Oh.
So during our business hours, so 8 to 4, they could come by and drop food off anytime.
Oh, okay. So individuals can come in and yes. drop things off. I noticed parking's a little tight, too. So there's a lot of people.
Yeah, this building is a little tight, period. I hate to see when the semi-trucks come to drop off food because the docks are so tight that they jackknife it in, and I don't want to see how they get the trucks in without taking half the building, but they do it somehow. And yeah, if you go to some of our offices, it's 2 or 3 people to an office, so it's tight here. We're running out of space.
I will say driving those trucks is a gift.
And yeah.
There's a certain amount of spatial orientation that I think you're either born with or you're not, right?
Yes, exactly.
Are there any things that you don't take here?
Do you want to answer that, Carrie?
So we take all non-perishable foods. So if you're dropping food off, I would go for non-perishable food things, cereal, canned goods, and other pasta sauce are things that we're looking for.
Yeah, the things that we probably wouldn't take, I mean, we could, but we try not to because we don't want it near the food, is things like household cleaning products or chemicals, things of that sort, WD-40 for the door, that kind of thing. Yeah. We'll take it, but we'll set it off to the side. Some of the strangest things we've received, pillows. Remember, we had 2,000 pillows that were donated to us. Because there was a manufacturing error, the label on the packaging said the pillows were made in this place, and the label that was actually on the pillow said it was made somewhere else.
Hmm. So somebody brought it up. Well, that'd be great for egg deliveries, maybe.
Yeah, 2,000 pillows. So we wound up giving them to partner agencies that could use them.
So tell me about the partner agencies. How many partner agencies are there, and what are they like?
So we work with about 150 partner agencies throughout the community, and it's anything from a church that has a small food pantry to a nonprofit to agencies that run soup kitchens. So we work with agencies like the Fort Myers Rescue Mission. We work with Catholic Charities, Salvation Army, but we also work with smaller churches.
So, I mean, any size. Now, how do people get involved if they have a church and they wanted to set up a food pantry?
Yep. So we ask that they be a 501c3 or a church, so a nonprofit or a church, and they would just contact us and let us know that they were interested in setting up a food pantry. There is a application they'd have to complete, and we'd go out and do an inspection and make sure that they have the space to properly store food and they have clients in the area that are in need.
Mm-hmm. So this has been going on since 1983. Have you guys both been here for a while?
7 years for me this past November.
And I've been here a little over 4 years.
So you guys have been here for a fair amount of mm-hmm. time. What have you seen? Any changes? Have you seen an mm-hmm. increase in need?
Yeah. When I got here, I think we were at about 11, maybe 12 million pounds of food. And now we're at 24. We just did our 200 millionth pound distribution about 3 weeks ago at two mobile pantries. And just to give you an idea, in 2014, we hit our 100 millionth pound in our history, and then fast forward 4 years to 3 weeks ago, and we were at 200 million pounds. So it's just, it's grown exponentially. It continues to grow. The need is still there. I mean, you have people who are culling together different jobs, part-time jobs for the most part, in many cases, and they just can't make ends meet because housing is too expensive. They have medical bills, the car, you know, they have a problem with their car and that's it. Whatever money, if they were lucky enough to have any saved up, is gone. So their last recourse is to come to a partner agency for service.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining the show today, I'm talking with Miriam Pereira. She is the Director of Development for the Harry Chapin Food Bank, which just so happens to be where we are broadcasting from today. We're getting a firsthand look at their year-round operation and effort to feed people who are food insecure in Lee, Charlotte, Collier, Glades, and Hendry counties. We're also joined by Carrie Lafort. She is the food bank's Director of Programs. We're not taking phone calls, though, during this hour. So if you'd like to make a comment, you can find us on Facebook at WGCU Public Media or on Twitter at WGCU. Using the hashtag of GCL. So because it's Harry Chapin Food Bank, it's not where people actually go to pick up food, right?
Correct.
So you maybe don't have a whole ton of interaction with the people who are directly impacted by the work that you're doing. Is there partner agencies really that have that?
Yeah, the majority of what we do really goes out through our partner agencies because they're the ones that are in the community where individuals live, so they can go to their neighborhood church and get food. But we do have a couple of programs that we work directly with clients, and that
the
would
mobile
be
food pantry.
Through our mobile food pantry program.
So how do you decide on that? How do you know where that's going to go, and how do you set that up?
Yeah, we're doing about 30 mobile food pantries a month, and we're really looking at areas that don't have a strong partner agency network. So we don't have a lot of partner agencies in that community, but there's a need. And then we're also doing our mobile food pantries at schools.
Okay. So, and then what kind of things, do you do something different there? Is it kind of like a week's worth of groceries, or how does that work?
Yeah, it's about 40 pounds of food that every family would walk away with. So approximately a little over a week's worth of groceries.
Mm-hmm. And Miriam, tell me a little bit about some of the people that you've interacted with. You were telling me earlier about Mary down in Collier. She's an older woman. Mm-hmm. You know, we hear a lot about fixed income and seniors, but this woman's really on a fixed income, and it's just been hard for her to make ends meet to be able to afford food. Tell me a little bit more about her.
So Mary was a lady we met earlier this year when we did an event, and we wanted to really bring home the fact or try to get people to connect with people we serve. So we found Mary through Carrie's efforts, and Mary shared this story with us. She came to the event, and she's kind of become a food bank family member, if you'd like. My monthly income total is $770, $747 of which is in Social Security and $23 in disability payments. I also receive $16 in food stamps. I pay $217 in rent each month and make a few extra dollars sewing and altering my neighbor's clothes and selling secondhand items at my apartment complex's rummage sales. On a good month, I'll have $30 to spend on groceries. I rely on a senior bag food program provided by the Harry Chapin Food Bank to help me through the month.
So she has income of
$800. And she's lucky if she has $300 left a month. She lives in low-income housing, so it is subsidized, but she still needs to pay rent. And when she takes into account all of her other expenses and medical expenses and everything else, she's got about $30 left a month. So she came to the food bank through the senior bag program, which Carrie's department helps organize. And that's when we distribute two bags to seniors who have already been registered for this program to help supplement their diet. And if we have an additional produce or frozen meat or bread, it's something that we can also give to them along with those two bags, we do that. And Mary's been on that program for about 2 years now, maybe a little longer.
Carrie, tell me about that senior bag. What gave you the idea to do that? I mean, there are a lot of seniors down here that may be kind of on their own and may be embarrassed to ask for help from family far away.
Yeah, so the senior bags, I actually have another story of a client who got our senior bag program when we had first started it up in 2015. I got a phone call from an elderly gentleman, and he said that he had been holding on to my flyer for over a month, but he was too embarrassed to call. So I started talking to him a little bit about the program and how it would be two bags of nutritious food to supplement other food that he was able to get, and he started telling me that his medication went up. So he didn't know what he was going to do anymore, if he was going to pay his rent, his electric bill, or for food. And being able to get these bags every month, he's now able to not have to make those tough decisions every month.
I just can't imagine how hard it's got to be that guy that you're talking about, who's, you know, done fine for himself his whole life.
Yeah.
Now he's older. He's past working age. He doesn't really have that option. And then his medication goes up. It's just that one little additional expense that just had to push him to the point where then he had to call, and he didn't really want to.
And it took him over a month to call. You know, I mean, he had my flyer for a month, and he was probably in need that whole month or maybe longer. But it was finally to the point that he really didn't know what he was going to do. There was a desperation.
What kind of things do you have in the senior bags that are maybe different?
So there is canned vegetables, canned fruit every month. We always have some sort of protein. One of the things that we've been trying to put in the bags is soup. Mm-hmm. So we found that some of the seniors were having a harder time with cooking, and so that was one of the recommendations they said was easier to prepare food, so we started including soups.
That makes sense also, too, if you're already facing financial issues, you're not really going for the dental care, so you may have like a hurting tooth. So
yeah.
Soup is a much easier way to get it down there, right?
Yeah.
You know, so a little less chewing involved, you know?
Yeah, one great thing that Carrie did and her department did was they asked these clients, what would you like to see in your bags? What kinds of food you would like to see? And with this program in particular, they try the best they can to get health-friendly foods that are for seniors in their diet, so low-fat, low-sodium, for example, that sort of thing. And it's an expensive program because that's one of the few programs where we have to go out and buy the food for the because most of our food is donated. But in this particular case, we buy the food for that program because we can't rely on it as donations. You don't know what you're going to get from one day to the next necessarily.
That makes sense. Mm-hmm. I just think that need with the seniors has got to be pretty great. But then they're also families, and mm-hmm. it doesn't take a whole lot. And I talked with one of your clients before we went on the air today, and that was a woman that was working in a secretarial type of a job mm-hmm. and had one blowout of a tire mm-hmm. on her car. Put her into a guardrail, and she injured her neck, unable to work, went on disability, and she has a family. She has two older daughters. She has some grandkids, and she's that on the disability, she's just unable to make ends meet. She said, when I talked to her, she said she thanks God every single day for a Harry Chapin food bank. And it's because of you guys that she actually was able to have a Thanksgiving with her family. Otherwise, that just wouldn't have happened.
Those are the kinds of stories that make me come in every day. You should have been here during Thanksgiving. I'm not kidding you. That's the forklift. I'm sorry. Backing up.
That's okay. They're doing good work. I'm not going to complain about it.
So we had more than 3,000 turkeys come through the door.
3,000 turkeys. That's
3,000 frozen turkeys come through the door. And we also had holiday meals that Publix donated as well. And so much of it went out to the partner agencies. And I'm sure that's how she received her food, either that way or through a mobile pantry. And it made... it made a holiday for quite a few people. And it's something that you and I are fortunate enough to probably take for granted, but it not for a lot of people in this community. That's a hard thing to explain. I mean, it's a very quiet problem. You don't go around saying, hey, I can't afford to put food on my table. You can skip a meal and nobody will pay you any mind.
Yeah, well, her story was she was on disability, then she wanted to go back to work part-time because she wanted to take care of her mother, who was also dying and sick, and so she elected to stay near her mom to help take care of her, and that ended up kind of leading to the lack of employment. And then you have all the other expenses, and it's just, I think that until you're there, you don't really understand it's like, because there's one bill or one medical emergency. I mean, everybody says it. You hear it all the time. But until you're there, you don't really know exactly how that feels and what that situation is. You told me about the Garcia family earlier down in Collier.
Yeah. So another family we met, again, it was Carrie helped us find this family. And they came and spoke at one of our events down in Naples earlier this year, too. And their story is... this is the mom explaining their situation. I'm married with four children. I believe life is what you make it and enjoy helping when I can and however I can. But sometimes life just happens. Recently, I've had to miss a lot of work as a general assistant at an elementary school in Collier County due to my younger children's medical evaluations. If you don't work, you don't get a paycheck. I'm left with the difficult decision of paying a necessary bill or buying groceries. We don't qualify for government assistance, so providing a nutritious meal is more difficult. Sometimes buying any kind of food feels out of reach. And we hear stories like that every single day.
And it's necessary and nutritional, but it still kind of feels like a luxury because there's nobody banging on your door asking you to pay your bill for your food.
Exactly. You know? That's exactly right. And it's, you know, cheaper to go to a fast food place or to a convenience store and buy something that's processed that'll fill you up, but you do that long enough and then there are repercussions for it.
More health bills.
Exactly.
Right, exactly. If you're hearing the forklift in the background, we are on location at the Harry Chapin Food Bank's Fort Myers warehouse today. We're seeing what it takes to provide food to more than 28,000 people every week across Southwest Florida. We're talking with the Food Bank's Director of Development, Miriam Pereira, and Carrie LaFort. She is the Food Bank's Director of Programs. If you'd like to weigh in on our discussion, catch us on Facebook. We're at WGCU Public Media, or on Twitter. We're at WGCU using the hashtag of GCL. Before we let you go, I wanted to ask you both, do you need volunteers? Is there a need for that?
We do. We absolutely need volunteers.
We could use them. We'll take sweat equity any day. We'll put them to work. We have all sorts of things for them to do, whether it's sorting through food drive food, packing whatever produce we have, or going through frozen meat that we get. There's always something for them to do. And the other cool thing that we've been doing is Family Volunteer Day, which is once a quarter on a Saturday morning, we open the warehouse to families with smaller children. We can't do that, obviously, because it's a working warehouse during the week. But we know that their kids out there have to do community service for school, and usually the cutoff point is about age 16. With this program, they can be 10 years old and older and come in. And we have them do about three different activities. So they might sort produce. Then we have them color the bags, the paper bags that we use for the senior bag program, because it, you know, it brightens up the senior's day.
And can I tell you how much the seniors love that? I was just at a distribution last week, and the seniors came to me, and they were like, we want bags that were colored on them. We love those.
That's so cute.
Yeah, and sometimes the kids will write notes and put the notes in the bags, too.
Oh.
Yeah, and even the parents get in on it, too. And it's just something we didn't, you know, we were trying to think of what can we get kids to do that... gets her creativity going.
And I think that kind of connection with the seniors is going to be just really great.
And we do that at both our Naples and Fort Myers location on the same Saturday. And the next one is coming up. The date just slipped my mind, but I can get that for you and give it to you.
Can you find out, how do people find out more about these kinds of events and get in touch with you all?
They can come to our website, harrychapinfoodbank.org. They can also check out our Facebook page. And we send out e-blasts as well, informing people about the events that are coming up. So if you'd like any of that information, just visit our site or call us at 334-7007 and we can give you more information.
And you can find all those links at gulfcoastlive.org as well. So, but that's all the time that we have for this part of today's show, but I want to thank you guys, my guests, Miriam Pereira. She's the Director of Development for the Harry Chapin Food Bank, which is where we're sitting right now. And I would like to thank the forklift operator for beeping because it's evidence that we're really here. Also, I want to thank Carrie Lafort. She's the Food Bank's Director of Programs. Carrie, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
When we return, we're going to explore the growing problem of affordable housing in Southwest Florida with someone from the Urban Land Institute and Florida Gulf Coast University Professor Dr. Christopher Wesley, who's also director of the Regional Economic Research Institute. I'm Julie Glenn, and you're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. According to a 2018 report on housing in Lee County, there are more than 107,000 households spending more than 30% of their income on housing, and more than 52,000 households spending more than 50% of their income on housing. 30% is considered burdensome and 50% severely so, which means there's not much money left over for other things like food. And while unemployment is low, home prices and rents continue to increase faster than wages are growing. You can find similar numbers in other Southwest Florida communities. So while we spent the first half of the show today learning how the Harry Chapin Food Bank fills some of those food gaps for people stretched thin, now we're turning to one of the biggest reasons people have a hard time affording food, housing costs, and transportation costs if you have a long commute. Let's hear that conversation now. One of the things that leads to food insecurity is a lack of affordable housing. And when the rent is too high, but is completely necessary to pay, that leaves little room for things like milk and bread. One organization that, according to its website, provides leadership in the responsible use of land and in creating and sustaining thriving communities worldwide is the Urban Land Institute. Philip Payne is with the Urban Land Institute, among other projects, and last year he spent some time in Southwest Florida, where he put together a report for Collier County concerning its housing situation, which is a familiar one across the region. People who live and work here can't afford to live here. He's with us now to talk a little more about the problems facing communities that are heavily reliant on tourism and the service industry, problems that aren't necessarily unique to Southwest Florida. Philip, it's good to talk with you again.
It's good to talk with you.
So when the talk turns to affordable housing, do people have a tendency to tune out?
Well, they don't tune out. They talk a lot about it. It's when they tune out is when it comes to doing something about it, which is the real issue. So everywhere you go now, everybody's talking about the crisis in affordable housing. That's nationwide. It comes up in every meeting on housing. It comes up in every zoning hearing. It comes up in every meeting of builders or designers or urban planners or government officials. But what's happening is there's not much action being taken because it is a major problem that takes some bold initiatives that frequently aren't popular with the electorate, let's put it that way.
Is it because there's a perception about affordable housing that may be incorrect?
We've all heard, I'm sure you've heard of the term NIMBYism, which is not in my backyard kind of approach. There is a lot of what I'll call myth surrounding affordable housing. One, what it looks like. Two, about who lives there. And three, what impact it has on neighborhoods in terms of property values and the perceived risks of safety and other issues that come along that just aren't true.
Well, yeah, so it's like there's a really big disconnect between reality and the idea of what people think affordable housing is going to be, or workforce housing, or however it's labeled. We're talking about people that work in schools, that are firefighters, that can't afford to live in the communities that they're working in.
Yeah, and one of the, I mean, the industry has somewhat created its own problem trying to find a word that doesn't set off alarms, and so the terms have become so intermeshed with one another, they're almost meaningless. So, you know, there's first to the question of what is affordable housing and what does that really mean. I would break it more into what we would call workforce housing, which is available to people between 80% and 120% of area median income. And then you would get into affordable housing, which would be for people under 80%. Low income would be for people under 60%, and extremely low income would be for people under 30%. You know, when you if you use the word low income in a political discussion, it brings up more, even more resistance. So people switch to the word affordable, and because of they replace low income with affordable, people always think when you're talking about affordable housing, you're talking about the very lowest level of income housing. But really what, you know, when the ULI group, you know, we were originally brought because of the issue of workforce housing in Collier County and the lack of housing that's affordable to school teachers, firemen, policemen, emergency workers, hospital workers. And then that expands and even larger when you consider the number of service jobs as a percentage of total jobs in Collier, which means all the people who work in the restaurants, whether they go from all the way from the maitre d' and chef down all the way to the dishwashers. And then your hospitals, you know, but not the highly skilled people, but, you know, emergency techs and the people doing the running the equipment and taking drawing blood and down through the orderlies who keep the place clean. And there's just this absolute critical shortage of housing for that range of people, right, who are all working, by the way. They just don't make enough to afford the housing that's in Collier. What's happening in Collier is people are being forced farther and farther out. A surprising number of county employees now live in Lee County. But when you add the cost of the commute to the cost of their housing, their burden on just getting living and getting to and from work is straining them beyond the limit. So you were losing people because they can't afford to live in Collier. So the pool of people you have to be your policemen, your firemen, your school teachers in particular.
What kind of things, though, can a local government do to impact that? Are we talking about adjusting property taxes? Or what kind of impacts can a local government, like a county commission, have on something like that?
There are five sort of critical approaches that you do as a multi-phased approach. Not one of these in and of itself can solve the problem. So you have to look at all of them and try and use them combined. The first would be regulation and governance, and we'll come back to that in a second. The second is just to increase supply. Whether you're talking low income, homelessness, any of those issues, the best thing that can happen in a community is that the overall supply of housing goes up. And that is, quite frankly, regardless of price range, the amazing thing. I mean, remember, if there's a shortage, who gets to buy what's there? It's the higher dollar income people. So if there's just not enough housing, the high-end people are going to be okay. It's their pricing out. They will actually force the prices up. They'll absorb the supply and leave nothing. So having more supply of all types of housing at all price ranges is critically important. So when you come from a government regulation and rules approach, everything needs to be focused on how do we increase more supply. Do the rules that we're putting in place actually increase the supply of housing? One of the words that everybody's got to come to terms with, I refer to it as the D word.
Density.
Which is density.
Okay? I knew that was coming.
There is this belief that is just flat wrong that appropriately used increases in density destroys the quality of the neighborhood. Collier, for example, when we were there a year ago, and I assume it hasn't gotten much better, you had a fairly meaningful number of strip malls that were either dead or close to dead along major transportation corridors, taking those centers and rezoning them as high-density residential areas. And by density, you know, I mentioned this at the public hearing and was the one time I thought I might get shouted down, but there is nothing wrong with 30 units per acre in a properly done thing. I doubt anybody would ever realize that it was 30 per acre. It's being done all over the country, some in much higher density than that, but we're not talking about high-rise apartment.
Yeah, people have visions of projects.
Yes, and these are not projects. I mean, I think that's one of the things that's fallen out is that just because property has higher density and slightly smaller units than we've traditionally seen in order to hold the cost down, but the efficiency of building two, you know, three stories, four stories, I mean, it's not higher than the roof lines of the multi-million dollar homes that are being built in some of these golf communities. I mean,
what does it take to make that happen, though? I mean, you know, it sounds great, but do you have to have a developer that's willing to put out the money to make that happen? Do you have to have the city getting in on it? I mean, who builds it?
There will be a developer who builds it, but he's got to know that there's going to be an attitude that we really want it, which comes to this rules and regulations again about, you know, we're at a point in time when a builder wants to build something, and depending on the particular locality, it can take anywhere from a few months to several years before you can get through planning and all the review. And that all costs money, by the way. That all that time adds to the cost of the project.
Yeah, having money tied up, it's not going to be making money while it's sitting there. And that makes sense. But in the end, once you have your permitting and you've gotten your land, your developer, is it worth it in the end for them? Or do developers shy away from these things because the end payoff isn't that great? I mean, not just because it takes a long time to get things done if the community's not back
in. The end payoff can work. Particularly in a place like Collier, the end payoff can work. It's just, it depends on how many hoops you have to jump through and how long it's going to take.
Well, it's not like they're going to sit empty.
No. No, that's the question is, can you build things that people can afford? And certainly, given the housing situation in Collier, there are plenty of people who could afford to live in those units, okay? Now, then the question is, which we can come back to, if it's really meaningful for the city, then getting some concessions, whether it's in the density, and I don't mean an extra three units, I mean getting some real concessions in density to get bigger density levels, getting some streamlined processing to get the work so you can go quicker, making any zoning vote occur day one, not at the end. And the zoning votes almost invariably fail. And one of the recommendations we made in Collier was that the idea of having every person who's on the Board of Commissioners be represented district, while it sounds very democratic, can totally stymie the work that needs to be done on behalf of the county as a whole.
I think I recall your recommendations also called for having more board members on the county board.
We were recommending that they put more board members on and have some at-large members. Every place that I go across the country where we see that there is really struggling with the issue of affordable housing has virtually the same form of government, whether it's a city council or whether it's a commission. Every member on the board represents a particular district. And if somebody comes in and says, I want to put 120 apartments in a high density or higher density, 30 units to the acre project, voters in that district object, their councilman, because his survival depends totally on the votes of his district. And his district has been very vocal that they don't want it. While it may be better for the county as a whole, he's in a position where if he votes for it, he's going to lose his seat. And we normally find what's called, generally called councilman prerogative or board member supervisor prerogative, which says if he votes no for anything in his district, all the other people vote no with him because they know they're going to be in the same boat down the road. And so what happens, there's nobody looking at the county as a whole or the city as a whole. They're only looking at their little individual districts. And housing is not only a countywide, it's an area-wide issue.
Another one of the problems that we have here in Southwest Florida is that push and pull between the environment and development. One of the solutions that you suggested, using existing empty storefronts and tearing those down and making that into more of a high density type of a, not super high, but, you know, like you mentioned earlier, a type of a development that would kind of alleviate some of that push that we're seeing inland that is putting, you know, wildlife areas and wetland areas in danger of being paved?
Yeah. Here's the problem from an environmental point of view. Sprawl is bad for the environment. The environment would be better off, let's say you had 30 acres and you're going to build four houses per acre, quarter acre lots. That's 120 units spread over 30 acres. What if we used 3 acres and did a 40 unit per acre multifamily development? So the use of that land right there is fairly intense. That 3 acres, I mean, it's by the time you put all the buildings and you put the parking lots and the stuff that needs to be done, you've really used those 3. But that's left you with 27 acres that haven't been touched, which to my mind is a lot better than taking the 30 acres and covering it with fescue, or I guess down where you are, Bermuda grass.
I'm wondering about the impact fees that we pay in this area, too, in order to build out into the sprawl area. You're going to have the impact fees of having to build the roads and all the infrastructure that it requires to continue to sprawl outward.
That was one of the things that's another issue down there. I mean, Collier has a philosophical concept right now that growth should pay for growth. And so they do this calculation of what the impact on the community is and that the new properties have to bear the burden of that cost. That has led to some extraordinarily high, in my experience, impact fees, which makes building affordable housing really hard. If you're starting off, I'm going to use sort of generic numbers for Collier County right now, if you'll bear with me, and just these are more national numbers than there are Collier, but it can't be far off. Not much can be built in the multifamily world for less than $150,000 per unit. But when you have a 20-something thousand-dollar impact fee, I don't know that anything can be built for $150,000 a unit.
That was Philip Payne from the Urban Land Institute. We spoke yesterday. And joining me for the rest of the hour to bring the issue even closer to home is Dr. Christopher Wesley. He's a professor of economics at Florida Gulf Coast University and the director of the Regional Economic Research Institute at the university's Luttgert College of Business, which closely tracks things like the region's economy and where housing fits into that equation. Dr. Wesley, welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. Thanks for meeting us here at the Food Bank, at Harry Chapin's Food Bank, to have this conversation.
Hi, Julie.
We're not taking phone calls because we're on location, but if you'd like to weigh in on our discussion, you can find us on Facebook at WGCU Public Media or on Twitter at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So I wanted to have you reflect on Philip Payne's comments. He seemed to be very focused on increasing the supply and also things that can be done on the local level to lift some restrictions and impact fees to make it more appealing for developers to put more houses in.
Yeah, his last comment about there not being housing available for $150,000 or less, I thought that was interesting. The last house I lived in wasn't worth much more than that.
Yeah.
Of course, it wasn't in Florida either. Maybe that's why.
That could be it, yeah.
But it made me think about those miniature houses they're building in Cape Coral right now. This is an effort to try to get around that as well and try to make... Sometimes I wonder if the hipness of miniature houses is partly related to this whole issue, too, to find housing that's desirable and affordable.
The tiny home movement, you know, it's really done well as far as an HGTV thing, but I wonder how realistic that is. Because where would you put your Christmas tree when the Christmas season's over? That is the question. But he's talking about increasing supply and some of the local things that can be done by county commissions as far as moving permitting through and being more open to greater density of housing. He also talked a little bit about impact fees and how that can cut into the price of a home. We were talking a little bit earlier about the ceiling that there is on what is considered affordable housing and how that impacts the incentive for developers to even get involved in that.
Well, I was saying that the existence of home price inflation, which is generated by, you know, increasing the money supply across the country, seems to affect our region more than other regions of the country. And the reason for this is there's more money coming down here than other parts of other states, actually. And then what happens is that bids up. That doesn't make us suddenly richer. It just increases the prices of existing assets.
People are willing and able to pay more for a house that would not get that much somewhere else.
Sure. And so by definition, affordable housing is going to have a ceiling above which it's no longer affordable, which means that builders have incentives maybe to shy away from that type of housing because their profit margins aren't going to be as high. And they're more, given the current situation, their incentives then are to naturally try to focus maybe on gated community housing or other types of housing, and then high-end housing because the prices can be charged a lot higher than what their costs are in that situation.
The sky's the limit there.
And that's not necessarily the case with if there's that inflation is not there otherwise.
Well, people think about inflation, and whenever I hear the word inflation, I feel 100% powerless.
Don't do that.
I feel like I don't, first of all, I feel like I don't really understand it that much, but I also feel like I don't have a full concept in my mind as to how that actually impacts things.
Well, I mean, it causes the prices, inflation is increasing the money supply, and it causes prices of goods and services to go up. And what we've seen over the, I mean, definitely since 2001 is that the authorities are pretty good at keeping the core inflation relatively low, but they do that in a bubble-plagued economy. And one of the bubbles we've seen is in some areas of the country has been in real estate. And so Southwest Florida is a area where that has been the case. It was clearly the case in Cape Coral back in the mid-2000s. And we're nowhere near that right now, but the same phenomenon does occur to the extent that now the median home price in Collier is about $450,000. It's about $250,000 in Lee, which is a lot better, a little bit less in Charlotte right now. And so this creates problems for people whose incomes is less sufficient for them to be able to afford housing in the region. It also places a lot more importance on the role of family and two-income houses in order to survive.
Yeah, that's true. And when you say the word bubble, I think we're all familiar with the word bubble in this area as it relates to real estate. Is that a phenomenon that tends to occur in places that are second home destinations and vacation and tourist-driven economies?
Well, we know where it seems to happen, not necessarily. Usually it tends to happen, I think, more in high-income regions of the country.
But there's not high income here that's being earned here. It's coming from somewhere else.
There definitely is in Collier. The news today about Port Royal being the richest neighborhood in the country right now.
Well, I believe that, but I think that most of that money was made in Ohio. But it seems like everybody comes from the Midwest or something.
But it's spent down here. And I'm just saying that there is an assumption that when new money enters the economy, we're richer, which isn't true. That doesn't make us have more stuff. And then when new money enters the economy, the assumption is that it spreads out equally around the country, and actually it doesn't. More of it comes down to, say, the state of Florida than goes to the state of Alabama. In the last boom, more of it went to Las Vegas or San Francisco than it went to, say, Des Moines or Statesboro, Georgia.
I understand what you're saying, but it just feels like, yeah, it is the richest, place. However, the people that actually live and work there, like year round, are not. And the problem is that seasonality, and that just also makes it even worse because we're very service dependent as far as our employment in this area.
That's sort of the Achilles heel of this economy, and I do think it's going to get better as we grow and develop as a region. But you're right, because the two things that make this region especially desirable is its favorability for tourism and for retirement. And from those two areas come many different industries to cater to them, and many of those industries tend to have entry-level or service or to not use a term that Philip Payne was using, low-income wages.
Yeah, I mean, but even here, low-income is higher than low-income in a lot of other places,
It's all relative to the prices that you have to pay to live in a given area.
Which I'm learning is impacted greatly by inflation. If you're just joining the show, the reason you're hearing a forklift in the background is because we are at the Harry Chapin Food Bank. We've been here live for the hour for Gulf Coast Live, and we're currently talking with Professor Dr. Wesley from FGCU. He is the director of the Regional Economic Research Institute. He's also professor of economics there at FGCU. Dr. Christopher Wesley is talking with us about the lack of affordable housing in our area, which is what in many cases leads to people finding themselves unexpectedly food insecure, usually pushed there by one event. You know, it takes a car wreck or a bad medical bill to put somebody in that type of a position. I wanted to ask you a little bit about how Southwest Florida compares to other communities when it comes to the housing situation. Are we that far off as far as the rest of the country?
I don't think so. This is an issue I hear show up all over the country right now. The affordable housing is a problem, and that kind of underscores this point I was making about inflation, because it seems to be having the same effect in other markets as well. And the issue then becomes, how do we attract industry to the area if the workers here decide, well, my take-home pay might not justify making the move there in the first place? And that's going to vary in Collier, Lee, or Charlotte counties as to what kind of firms that come down here. In my opinion, especially in Collier and a little bit less so in Lee, you're going to want to attract industries that allow that the productivity of the individual worker justifies a higher wage that worker would want to have to live in this area.
Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, is there any way to make progress on this issue without the government getting involved?
Well, I mean, I think there should be a discussion more about the long-term effects of, you know, increasing the money supply to the degree that we have. And that's usually not on the table, but that has caused the prices to go up.
And that's a federal situation.
It's a federal situation because they control the money supply.
Yeah.
But we so often focus on wages and how much money firms are paying their workers and whether it's just or not. And really, I keep on coming back to productivity, because if a worker's wage is higher than their productivity and the revenue that creates, firms are losing money on those workers and they're not going to keep them, which means that raising wages on its own is not going to be the solution in a lot of cases. And a lot of times you're hurting labor when you do that because you price them out of the market.
Yeah.
But we often focus on that aspect of the issue, and we don't focus on, well, what's causing prices to rise at such a fast rate down here? And that's what I'm trying to emphasize.
Well, it's interesting, though, that we're talking kind of like about the value of money because of the inflation. So if the value of the money is, you know, diluted by inflation, then the value of the money that is being paid to the people that are working is also diluted. Is not the value of the money that is being paid for the goods created by those employees also diluted?
It depends on the price of the good, because what gives money value is how much stuff you can buy with it. And so when prices are rising and when there's monetary inflation, you can buy less with that money. And when prices are falling, you can buy more with that money. So we would be indifferent to getting a raise. If I get a raise of, say, 10%, but prices go up 20%, I'm really no better off because of that.
Exactly.
Or let's say my wages go down 10%, but prices fall even more, I'm actually can buy more with that money, because it's what at the end of the day, it's the purchasing power of income and what you can buy with it.
So I'm sure you heard about it in the news, because it was all over the place when Amazon was trying to figure out where to put its new headquarters. And I would imagine that you probably followed that. What do you think about local governments trying to incentivize large employers coming to their area? Is that the way that a county government should go? For example, Lee or Collier County, should they be trying to attract industry to their area, or should they be spending money on trying to solve affordable housing situations?
Well, sometimes by attracting industry to an area, you might be exacerbating the affordable housing problem, because workers are coming in at a faster rate than housing is increasing, which then bids up prices for everybody in the region. So that you might be making the problem worse. But I think that economic growth should be organic to a region, and the authorities in the county should be careful about what industries they bring to the region, so that they're good fits.
So they don't make it even harder for the people that are in the service industry that we have to have in this area because of our tourism and all that, to make it possible for them to continue to live here.
Sure.
And I'm wondering if, as an FGCU professor, if you feel that it is sometimes difficult to try to convince these students to stay in our area if, when they graduate college, they can't afford to live here.
You know, that's less of an issue than it was 20 years ago.
It was worse.
Yeah, it was a lot worse. And one effect of FGCU is that we are training workers with certain skills that are now attracting capital to the area that wasn't coming here before. And so the job market is actually better for our graduates than it was when we first got started, for that reason.
Well, that's some good news.
Yeah.
Well, we'll leave on some good news.
Good.
But that's about all the time that we have for today's show. But I want to thank my guest. Dr. Christopher Wesley is the director of the Regional Economic Research Institute and a professor of economics at the Leckert College of Business at Florida Gulf Coast University. And I also want to thank my earlier guests, Miriam Pera and Carrie Lafort from the Harry Chapin Food Bank, where we are reporting from live today for Gulf Coast Live, in case you have been wondering about all the strange noises in the background. It's been great being out here. Our show today was produced by Mike Canary and myself. Our director is Richard Chin Kui. Also, Kevin Trueblood helping out today exponentially with all of the wire running in the remote location. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.